Okay, as I just mentioned a few moments ago, the title of today's talk is Buddhism and Sex. But I'm sorry to disappoint you, because the sex part is spelled S-E-C-T-S. Because... because next week His Holiness the Dalai Lama is coming, and he's a Tibetan Buddhist, and some people are Mahayana Buddhists, and we're Theravada Buddhists, and we have nuns, and we have Zen monks, we have all sorts of different monks and nuns, and people from different sects of Buddhism, and I thought it's a good time to talk about Buddhism and the sects of Buddhism. I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I couldn't resist that sort of... not really deception, I was quite honest. But there are, obviously with the arrival of His Holiness the Dalai Lama next week on Wednesday, that people will be asking the question, well, you know, Dalai Lama, is he the same as you guys? And is he the leader of Buddhism? And how does it all work out? And are you guys friends? And do you have arguments? And if you do have arguments, why do you have arguments? Is it just the same as, you know, the Shiites and the Sunnis? Are you going to go to war soon? You know, what is it with all these different types of Buddhism? That's going to be the talk this evening. Now, the point is that if ever you read the books, I'm talking about the ancient scriptures, or you read the books written by scholars in universities who never come out of their rooms and haven't got really much of a hold on real life, and that's unfortunate, that's the case sometimes. You know, I just come back from a conference in Bangkok, and some of the stuff which the university professors say, even though they're really, you know, nice people, sometimes they say, are you talking about Buddhism? Do you really know, you know, what's happening on the ground? And obviously they very often don't. But if you read those books or read those scholars, they start saying there's three different types of Buddhism. There's the Hinayana, the small vehicle, the Mahayana, the big vehicle, the Vajrayana, the diamond vehicle. And the problem is that once you have any difference, the next question is, which one is the best? And you know the answer to that? Whichever one you ask, you say, our one is the best. Because that's the trouble when we have differences. Once we have differences, we start to sort of judge. And we usually judge out of conceit, which is the best vehicle. And that really basically upsets me. I always use the Australian word, pisses me off, when you sort of have Buddhists saying, I'm better than you are, my teacher is more enlightened than your teacher. Because I had enough of that when I was a kid with Christians and with other people, you know, who was the best. But unfortunately that was actually said in the books in ancient times. And sometimes those things are repeated and they both confuse people. And also to disappoint people. That's why hopefully you'll never hear monks or nuns here say that we are the best. Because that is just pride and arrogance. It's much better to see that, unfortunately, that those monks and nuns, those Buddhists of these traditions, who didn't really understand what these teachings were and what they really meant, who just saw the outer shell of these teachings, it's natural, because of our pride, because of our arrogance, always to think that we've got the best temple. And our teacher is the most enlightened. And our nuns are the best in the whole of Australia. Actually, they're the only ones in Australia, just about. So they are the best in Australia. But what actually happens is that when we start that arrogance, we're missing out on an important part of Buddhism. The arrogance has no part in spirituality. Instead, it has a mutual respect, which doesn't judge from one person to another person. It doesn't matter whether you are of whatever tradition, it's how you use that tradition makes you worthy of respect or not worthy of respect. It's the same with any other sort of religions. It's not really which religion you are, it's but how you use those religions. It doesn't matter what sort of gender you are or what sexual orientation you are, whether you're gay, whether you're straight, or whether you're celibate like the monks and nuns. It's how you use that vehicle which is most important in life. So just making blanket statements such as one tradition is better than the other goes completely against the truth, the reality of what Buddhism actually is. So if ever you hear the different traditions and one is better than the other, please understand that that has no grounding in Buddhist teachings at all. And number two, is that sometimes that people stress, you know, there are differences in these traditions. And according to the books and the scholars, you know, the tradition of Theravada, the one you see here every Friday night, we're supposed to be the selfish tradition. That's what it says in the books. And the Mahayana tradition is supposed to be the unselfish tradition, which goes out to help all sentient beings that doesn't care for themselves. But all you need to do is actually to go on the internet and see my itinerary so far this year. And if I have been selfish, I don't know how much more I can give for others. I've been travelling around so much, even the last month. We have Vaisak Day on Sunday, the celebration of the Buddha's birth, enlightenment and final passing away. And it'll be the fourth one I've done this year in three countries, four cities, doing Vaisak ceremonies. And anyway, I'm very actually happy with my travels, because even last Tuesday night, on the way back from Bangkok, I stopped over in Singapore, not to have a rest, but to do an opening ceremony of the group which I lead in Singapore, about 2,000 strong, called the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, which has been building up over the last 6 or 7 years, and finally moved into a temple. And I was very proud, you know, to be giving a speech, you know, at this temple, because it was a Mahayana temple, and we're basically a Theravada group. What we've done, actually, we've joined those two groups together. So two different traditions are sharing the same temple space. And I thought that's a wonderful thing to do. And that Buddhist fellowship, we do have a patron who's a Mahayana monk. He's the head of the Buddhist Federation in Singapore, Venerable Kwang Sheng. I've known him for many years. He's a good friend, and we get on very well together. He's also got a great sense of humour, which helps him being a good friend of mine. People who don't have senses of humour, I just cannot get on with. But nevertheless, okay, maybe it's a good time for this evening's joke. I got this morning from Ajahn Sujato, who's in our monastery in Sydney. There were these angels, they're devas, and they were flying through the air on a cloudy day, and they got lost. So one asked the other, "Where are we?" And so he put his hand through the clouds, and "We must be in New York, because I can feel the Statue of Liberty." And they flew a little bit further, and said, "Where are we now?" "I'll put my hand through the clouds. We must be in Paris, because I feel the Eiffel Tower." They went a little bit further, and they were lost again. "Where are we now?" They put their hand down. "Oh, we must be in India. I can feel the Taj Mahal." And they went a little bit further, and said, "Where are we now?" And the fellow put his hand down. "We must be in Northbridge, in Perth." "How can you know that?" he said. "Oh, because I've just lost my wristwatch." Okay, so that's today's joke. So anyway, that was from Ajahn Sujato in Wat Santee in Sydney from this morning. Thank you, Ajahn Sujato. So I was sitting next to this fellow, and he keeps on calling me the Theravada monk with the Mahayana heart. And also when I was in Bangkok, I saw Dr. Yifa, who was at our global conference last year. And we always argue, not argue, but not an argument, it's a banter we have between us. She's from the Taiwanese Fo Kwang Shan group, and she's based in San Diego. She's a Mahayana nun, and I'm a Theravada monk. And I say, "When are you going to have some disciples?" Because she goes around from place to place, but she never trains any other nuns. And I said, "Look at me, I train all these disciples. I've got all these monks with me at the monastery." And, I tell her, "You are a Hinayana. You're selfish, Dr. Yifa, and I'm the Mahayana Bodhisattva." And of course, what we're doing is a trading places, because according to the books, it is the Theravada is supposed to be selfish, and the Mahayana is supposed to be giving themselves, not thinking about themselves, to all sentient beings. I say this to show that the truth on the ground, the reality is, there is no difference between these traditions. Now you'll see sort of so-called Theravada monks like myself going around the world, busting your gut to sort of teach other people, working really hard, spreading the Dharma, helping out, looking after other people, serving and giving until it hurts. What is the difference? And actually, in reality, there is no difference. Because no matter what Buddhist tradition you follow, the general training, teachings, principles of Buddhism, like virtuous conduct, which is common sense, that's why it's common to all traditions, being kind to others, being kind to yourself. One of the reasons why Buddhism is strong in that virtue is because all these beliefs and these dogmas, they actually confuse your virtue. They stop common sense having any power. Because when you believe the books, when you believe in the god or the priest, sometimes it goes against common sense. And so, okay, we better believe the book because God said that. Or we better believe the priest because they got a direct line to Allah. Or you've got to believe, the sort of the great whatever it is because they're the head of the tradition. And sometimes it's those beliefs and dogmas actually stand in the way of obvious common sense. But Buddhism, we don't have those beliefs and dogmas, and so common sense has the freedom to express itself. So what you hear here is common sense, but the amazing thing here is there's nothing to stop that common sense. There's no dogmas or texts to say, common sense is wrong, believe me instead. That's not there in Buddhism. So all the Buddhist traditions, because we are free of that dogma, we're free of the sort of the God principle or some ultimate being which is telling you what to do, it gives that common sense the freedom to express itself. And when you, those of you will go and see His Holiness the Dalai Lama next week, you say, wow, this is down to earth, this makes sense. And just the same as you hear from the monks or the nuns here or from any other teachers of the Buddhist tradition, this makes sense. Why doesn't other people teach this? It's because Buddhism, all the Buddhist traditions, have this common characteristic of being free from those things which obstruct this obvious common sense. And that's true for all our Buddhist traditions. And so that way we have a virtue which actually does make sense, which people can relate to, which they know is true. A good example is Buddhism and sex, S-E-X. With, say, homosexuality or contraception, and these are some things which people know in their heart, what's wrong with this? And in your heart, when you ask that question, there's nothing wrong with this at all. It's your feelings, your understanding of what virtue is, which is the natural ability of the human being to know what's good and know what's right. Buddhism frees that natural ability to express itself. So instead of believing, somebody else says this is wrong, but it feels right to me, but they said it's wrong, I better not do it. Instead of being confused, those obstacles are taken away, so even the natural understanding of virtue is there for you. Because one of the other standard things about Buddhism is something, I mentioned this in the radio interview this morning, because about some months ago, I did write an article to the West Australian complaining about the Dalai Lama, or a quote of the Dalai Lama, which said that homosexuals cannot be Buddhists. And I said, that's nothing to do with Buddhism. But that was brought up again in the newspapers. And one of the things which I mentioned is that we don't have a pope in Buddhism. And this goes back to a statement made by the historical Buddha just before he passed away. When people say, you're about to pass away, who's going to take over leadership from you? Who's going to lead Buddhism? And he made this powerful statement that when I pass away, there will be no personal leader for you. Let the teachings, let the training, let that be your teacher from now on. And because that was very clearly made and stated and remembered, it meant that there's no justification for having like a pope, an ayatollah, a head monk or a head leader or anything. And that was actually unique amongst the religions of the world, that the Buddha prohibited specifically having like a head of Buddhism. And instead the principles which he enunciated, let that be your leader. What that meant was Buddhism could never be organized. But because it could never be organized, we avoided the problems of corruption. You know, when you have power invested in one person or one group of people. And we all know what happens in religions when we do have people who have enormous amounts of power. It just happens that sometimes even good people, when they get in positions of power, you know, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And so that was Lord Acton said that. I always remember Lord Acton because I was born in Acton, and he was the Lord there many, many years ago before I was born. But that's what he said, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely, and even good people sometimes get corrupted by power. So because of that, Buddhism never had that sort of powerful person or group of people who could control the religion. That's why that every monastery, every temple stands on its own. It's successful or it doesn't successful, not because of who they are, but how they behave and how they teach. The only reason this place is successful is because it's good teachings, we've done the right thing, we've struck the right chord. That means that it's prosperous. Now, when we have that no leadership, it means we do have different groups, we do have different emphases, we do have different sects of Buddhism developing, because there's no universe unifying hierarchy in this teaching. And so because of that, when Buddhism went to Tibet, it developed the Tibetan form. When it went to China, it developed a Chinese form. When it went to Japan, it developed a Japanese form. And a lot of these different types of Buddhism are very much like cultural. And now we're developing like an Australian type of Buddhism, you know, where you sort of tell jokes and you say, I'm pissed off because of this. You know, we use the language of Australia, and we have to do that. It has to develop in that particular way to relate to the culture and to the language in the situation you're in. And as we develop the different cultural Buddhism, we should never think that those cultural Buddhisms, the cultural traditions, are making Buddhism different and that's better because that's more original or that's more effective, because it's effective in different contexts. But not only do we have like this common understanding of virtue, what's good, and the ethics of Buddhism, you know, which I've given many talks about here, are very useful to people because it's an ethics which you can respect and you can practice. Because sometimes I remember, when I was a Christian, when you go to church, you keep those ethics. When you go out afterwards, you wouldn't keep them. You know, you're only sort of a Christian when you went to church. Or if you did try and keep them, you know, your friends say, you're being stupid. What are you doing that for? It doesn't make any sense. And so sometimes you will not be proud of your ethics, or you'll be defensive about your ethics because they didn't make sense for most people. Buddhist ethics is just wonderful because they are respected. Even a year or two ago, when I was going through a Perth airport, as I do very often these days, talking with one of the immigration officers, you know, he just mentioned the Dalai Lama, and he just read one of his books, and he said, that guy's got his feet on the ground. And I thought that was a wonderful comment about Buddhism in general. So the Buddhist monks and nuns, you know, they have their feet on the ground. What they say relates to you. They relate to life. And it's not some airy-fairy dogma or superstition, which may be true and may not be true, and you'll only find out after you die when it's too late. It's much more important to have something which people can relate to and they think, this makes sense right now. This was what he meant by they have their feet on the ground. So it's a virtue which people can understand. And again, all those Buddhist traditions, now, there isn't a selfish Buddhist tradition. That idea of like one group of Buddhists being more selfish and the other group of people being more compassionate, that doesn't make sense to me. I've seen monks and nuns from all traditions being quite selfish, but I've seen monks and nuns from all traditions being incredibly compassionate. What sometimes I've seen has just made me cry. You know, some of the stuff. It was one of these, I won't say who it is, he's quite a well-known monk now in Sri Lanka. I was very inspired by him because he was a blood donor, and because he was a blood donor, he put his list on there for being a kidney donor. And in Sri Lanka, the health authority rang him up or called him because they had a match. Somebody needed a kidney, and they had a perfect match And can he supply his kidney to this person who needed one? But the problem was, so this monk, the donor, was a very devout Buddhist. And the one who needed the kidney was a fundamentalist Christian who was going around Sri Lanka converting Buddhists to being Christians. I said, would you like to give your kidney to a Christian so he can convert your followers? He said, what do you mean? I don't care what she uses it for. She needs it. Take it. And so he gave his kidney without a second thought. And that's like compassion. You know, sometimes you think, you know, giving donations, giving $10 or $100, you know, to the retreat center or the nuns monastery or whatever, that's one type of generosity, but giving your kidney to someone who needs it. Now, we're getting into big generosity now. Especially to someone who needs it. You don't think who they are or why they need it or what they're going to do with it. They need it, please take it. Now, those are inspiring. Or some of the Theravada monks, because I have to make a confession now. Last month, while I was in Singapore, I went to the movie theatre. The first time in 35 years I've been to a movie theatre. The Lido in Singapore. Now, of course, I wasn't doing anything bad here because it was a Buddhist film festival and I had to give a talk there. So it wasn't an ordinary movie. It was actually a documentary about a Zen monastery in San Francisco. It was the first time I was very disappointed. Because when I used to go to movie theatres, they used to give you ice cream. Didn't get any ice cream. I was very disappointed. But it was a Buddhist international film festival. They wanted me to give a talk, so I gave a talk there. But the film before that, which I didn't see, was a film about this Thai monk, you know, who was born up in the slums, and he was helping these scallywags, these drug dealers and street kids in Bangkok by actually teaching them kickboxing, because he used to be a kickboxer before. But, you know, the reason why they had this movie, but he was just doing such a lot of good work, taking these kids and giving them a life. Of course, you know, you think that that's not what a monk is supposed to do, but, you know, heck, he's helping somebody, why not? Not helping somebody, helping a lot of people. And so you see these incredibly compassionate and kind acts coming from all corners. It doesn't matter what tradition you are from, you see it happening. And that's why you can't say that one tradition is more compassionate than another, but what you can say that people in any tradition, some of the compassionate, more compassionate, some of them more, inward looking, but who cares? They're all doing good things, and let's respect everybody, no matter what their tradition is. Even when I was a monk, I was supposed to be in the meditating tradition. I know that sometimes that we're in the meditation, the forest monks, sometimes some forest monks did look down upon the city monks. Those city monks, they just indulge and they just read books all the time. Well, where's that ever going to get you? Until I came across a saying of the Buddha. He said, well, it's actually in the text, it was a saying of one of the Buddha's chief disciples. He said, look, you meditating monks, you shouldn't look down upon the study monks. They're important because, you know, they write books and you study those books to help you understand your meditation. You study monks shouldn't look down upon the meditation monks. In fact, everything which I read in there was saying we don't look down upon anybody. We respect the diversity within our traditions. And that's been so important to me as I travel the world, because you do hang out with all sorts of monks and nuns from all different traditions. And I'm so proud of being friends with all those traditions and making those bridges between the traditions and seeing that, yes, we have different coloured robes. And we have the different genders. The only reason here in Perth, our monks wear the lighter brown, and the nuns wear the darker brown, is so you know who's who. That's all. There's nothing special about that. You know if it's a monk or a nun. Because that's quite important sometimes. Because this actually happened here some years ago. You know, that we had one of our first nuns here. I think it was actually Sister Jitindria. And she was visiting for a while, and just after the morning lunch on a Saturday, one of the ladies decided to take her for a little tour around the sights of Perth for the first time. So she was in the car, you know, sitting next to another lady. There's the two of them in the front seat of a car, and they drove off from the community hall just round the corner here. And as soon as they drove off, I think it was a Thai lady started shouting out, "Hey, look, there's Ajahn Brahm sitting next to a girl. Where are they going?" And it was actually a very close call, because it was very lucky at that time when she was pointing to this brown figure with a bald head sitting in the front, the passenger seat of a car next to a young girl, I happened to come out and said, "Ajahn Brahm's over there, Ajahn Brahm's over here." And because she recognized that that couldn't be me, because I was actually standing right next to her, said, "I'm here," she realized there was a nun in the car, it wasn't me. But if I hadn't have come out there, she'd have gone around and said, "This Ajahn Brahm, you know what he gets up to when..." That's why we have the different colour robes these days. So you know, who the monks are and who the nuns are. That's the only reason we have the differences. And the only other reason why we have the differences in the colours of the robes, you've seen these monks from Bangkok having these bright yellow robes. You know what that is? If you've ever seen the traffic in Bangkok, so that's why they can avoid the cars. They can see them coming from... No, that's only a joke. That's not why they wear the bright yellow robes, to avoid being hit by traffic. The main reason they do that is because just the natural dyes. In the northeast of Thailand, where our tradition comes from, we used to dye our robes in jackfruit. Wouldn't they come out this browner colour? In other parts, you know, you dye your robes with other natural colours, they come out more red. Or in places like Korea, they don't have that type of wood. They use charcoal, which is why they have got the grey robes. And so the different colours of robe, they originated just because that was the natural dyes available at the time, just for simplicity. There was nothing else other than just simplicity and just what was available to dye your clothes at the time. And so it doesn't signify anything. That's why I say the different traditions of Buddhism are just like different, same cake with different icings. So this over here, this is the milk chocolate icing. Now, Sister Wayama and the nuns, that's the dark chocolate icing. So the Tibetan monks, like the Dalai Lama, that's strawberry icing. And the monks you see, you know, like Sister Wei Kan, that's the sort of the combination of vanilla with a bit of blackberry, because it's a bit grey icing. But if you go under the icing, it's the same type of cake. And that's what's really inspired me by going around the world, visiting other monasteries, visiting other teachers, and seeing that, you know, when you actually get into what's underneath what the books say, and how monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen of these different traditions, what they actually do, how they practice, there's no difference. So any differences between the sects of Buddhism is completely superficial. Which is why that I can get invited to these other temples to give talks, and we can have these discussions. I had this amazing discussion at one of these conferences some years ago with a German Tibetan monk, because I wanted to find out, you know, what's your meditation? What have you been doing when you go on these long retreats? There is the form of Tibetan meditation, the Mahamudra, which they call it. Is it different than, you know, what we do here, the jhana meditations? And we had a wonderful discussion, because being like a Western monk who could speak English, you could actually really get a good discussion going. Some of the problems why we have difficulties with understanding our different traditions is because the language. Because many of the traditional Buddhist monks, they may be, you know, the Chinese monks, you have to understand Cantonese if they come from Hong Kong, or Mandarin if they come from somewhere else, or if they're Vietnamese tradition, you have to understand the Vietnamese, and sometimes it's the language that creates those barriers. Even the Tibetan monks, only a few of them can speak good English. But here was a time when there was a Tibetan monk who spoke perfect, Tibetan German monk spoke perfect English. We had a great sort of conversation. I valued that for a long time. It's Lama Londrop, his name was. And I found he was doing exactly the same thing. The same deep meditations of calming the mind down, present moment awareness, silence, watching this breath, getting these beautiful lights and images up, and going into the jhanas. And it was so wonderful actually to see this was traditional Tibetan teachings, traditional Theravada teachings, traditional Mahayana jhana teachings. Because when you were going to the very deepest part of Buddhism,
you're finding absolutely no difference whatsoever, not an iota of difference. And the only difference is what's superficial on the outside. Even the idea of the Bodhisattva as sacrificing yourself for all other beings, as if that's different than the Arahat way of becoming fully enlightened for yourself. And I don't know how many times I've taught in meditation retreats, if you want to get enlightened, no way you can get enlightened, because it's the wanting, the desire, the craving, which is what agitates the mind, which stops you becoming still and peaceful. I don't know how many times I've taught this simile. You know, holding up a glass. This is for the camera in front of me. Holding up a glass and saying, can I hold this absolutely still? I try, and I've been trying for years holding a glass of water absolutely still. Those in the front row can see it's still moving. So what do? I try harder to keep this still. I still can't hold it still. I try even harder. I can try for years holding this still. I'd never be able to do it. How do you hold a glass of water still? Put it down. Yes. And once you put the glass of water down, actually it moves more at first. But after a few seconds, you'll find those in the front row can see that's much more still than I could ever hold it. That is the way to meditate in the Theravada tradition. That's how I was taught by Ajahn Chah, to let things go. Not to crave, not to grasp, not to hold, but to abandon. That's the way to deep meditation, that's the way to enlightenment. You can't want enlightenment. If you want it, you're putting this big obstacle. So what's the Bodhisattva way? You give up your self-concern, you give up wanting things. Completely the same. People who write the books, because all they know is the words, never the practice, they can actually manufacture differences. And they can argue differences. But when you get to actually doing something, doing that practicing, calming the mind, seeing the truth, seeing the stillness of the heart, the peace of the heart, the truth, nibbana. It's not two nibbanas or three nibbanas for each different tradition. It's all precisely the same. And the only way that we get that peace in meditation is to give up. To sacrifice this sense of self which is always wanting and grasping and making it happen. The more you want, the more you make a stronger sense of self. The more you just disappear and let go, the calmer the whole world becomes. That's why the Bodhisattva way of abandoning self-concern is precisely the same as the Arahat way of realizing anatta, non-self. There aren't two ways, or three ways, or four ways, or six ways. Absolutely exactly the same. Even some of the things which they say is the goal, you know, of giving enlightenment to others. And or one thing which I always really respect and make use of, you know, is the Buddha nature. That's supposed to be a Mahayana concept, that all beings have Buddha nature. But I have extended that just because it's a very useful teaching. Not just all beings have Buddha nature, but all experiences have Buddha nature. What do we mean by Buddha nature? Like the Buddha is like the awakened one. Buddha nature means that every being not only has the potential to be fully enlightened, but they also have a part of themselves which is like a Buddha. A part which you can respect and value. And I've used that when I've gone into prisons and seen these criminals who've done gross crimes. And I've advised that to people who are facing their enemies, people who have been cruel to you, abused you, and really hurt you badly. By using the Buddha nature method, we look at that person and we look at something inside of them which is like a Buddha, like a small spark of purity and goodness in that other enemy. You're seeing something in them which you can respect, which is apart from their cruelty, their hurt, and their abuse which they've given you. Even in your enemy, in the worst enemy, you know, Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein, George Bush, John Howard, I don't know who your enemy is, you can always see some beauty in there, some goodness, some Buddha nature. That's a powerful way of overcoming the hatred and the resentment which stops you being happy. Now, we all know that Buddhism is very, very strong on forgiveness. So much so that, you know, when I was asked, you know, at a concert in Singapore, based on my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, when they said, how many times should you forgive? You know, people have hurt you again and again. How many times in Buddhism should you forgive? The answer is always, one more time. In other words, you can always forgive. Because forgiving is letting go. It doesn't mean excusing or forgetting. It means saying, I'm not going to allow that to hurt me anymore. And giving another person a chance. Seeing there's something inside of them which is worth forgiving. It's like seeing a Buddha nature in somebody, in the worst criminal. Certainly the Buddha did that to this fellow Angulimala, this serial killer. 999 lives he took, according to the tradition. But still could forgive. And make that person into a saint. Sometimes when there hasn't been forgiveness, there's been wastes of human lives. People being killed or being imprisoned when they could be helping and serving. See, that punishment according to karma will come in its own way. You don't need to punish them anymore. But what that forgiveness does, or rather how you can start the forgiveness, seeing the Buddha nature in somebody else. But I've extended that not to just to people, but to experiences, to seeing every experience which you have in life has Buddha nature. Has the ability to awaken you. To give you wisdom, compassion and growth. And I found that very, very powerful. You know, whenever there's something goes wrong in my life, or some disappointment, or sickness, or pain. If you can't go to sleep at night, or you fail your examinations, or you stuff up somewhere. It was very, very dodgy when I first went to Bangkok, all the way from Perth, getting out really early in the morning, to get to the airport, to get on the plane. I think I got up about 3:30 in the morning. And by the time I got to Bangkok, you know, late in the afternoon, found out they'd scheduled me for a TV interview at 10:30 p.m. I just had time for a shower, quick shower, and back to the studios. Which is not so bad, but it was in Thai. Sometimes you think I'm fluent in Thai, but once, here in Perth, there were some visiting Thai people, and they asked for teaching. So I taught them maybe 15 minutes of Buddhism in Thai. And afterwards they were said that we're so impressed, we didn't realize that you could give a speech in Pali, which is like Sanskrit. So that wasn't Pali, that was Thai. Oh, the Thai people said, really? In other words, they didn't understand a word of it. Not one word. And here I was on live TV, making a complete idiot of myself, I thought, speaking in Thai. I did really well. There was actually two other Thai people there, two Thai monks being interviewed. One was the rector of Mahachula Lungkorn University, Venerable Dharmakosajan. And according to him, he was very good. But the other fellow, being interviewed, he was a Thai monk who was a resident in a Buddhist monastery in Oxford. And apparently, afterwards, my Thai, you know, even though I'm a Westerner, that came across much more fluent than this Thai guy who's been staying at Oxford for the last few years. And I thought, how can that be? And I remember, well, look, I was from Cambridge, he was from Oxford. Cambridge is always superior to Oxford. That's just a joke. But there you are, you know, you can actually do these things. And so what happens when you're really tired, you know, 10:30 in Bangkok is 11:30 here in Perth. You've been travelling all day, now you've got to speak in a foreign tongue, on live TV. So what I do, is this is Buddha nature, there's a possibility here, not to reject this, but to say this is an important, I'm going to learn a lot from this, this is going to be very interesting. So by not rejecting anything, but seeing it has an opportunity, has a value, it's like a Buddha experience. And especially the tough experience which I face, these are like the ones I really like the most. In a sense, they're the ones where you really learn, and where you hone your abilities to be really tired, but still be able to teach in fluent Thai. Every experience has a Buddha nature. So it doesn't need to be rejected. It doesn't need to say, I'm going to get this out of the way to go back to real life. Otherwise, how many hours, days, months, years of your life are you wishing away? To get this out of the way, to do what you think life really is. If you're one of those people, always wishing away hours, days, weeks, years of your life, you're missing out. You've only got so many years. You can't afford to waste even one day, one hour, one moment. So when you say every experience, every moment has Buddha nature, you're valuing everything, even the painful experiences when you have to go and have chemotherapy or have some terrible operation. That has Buddha nature. That's important. These are opportunities for awakening. Awakening to what? Awakening to the truth of life. Your body is out of your control. You should know that by now. You just have to be with it. And the more you fight that body, the more you say, I don't want to be sick. I don't want to have that chemotherapy. I don't want to be better. As soon as you want something else, you are creating this mental suffering. When you respect the experience you have as being part of things, and you don't discriminate between the nice experiences and the bad experiences, but you respect every experience as teaching you, as a Buddha, as a moment for awakening, then you never try and wish away any part of your life. When you never wish away any part of your life or any person in your life, imagine how much peace and compassion and wit you have in your life. Everything is now respected. It's the old simile which I learnt in Thailand. And also, I really learnt it very strongly when I first came to Perth. When we moved down to Serpentine, when we bought this forest monastery where a lot of Jarrah trees were suffering from dieback. They were dead trees. And what did a person like me, a perfectionist, let's cut down those dead trees. They're ugly. Who wants to have these dead skeletons in your beautiful forest? When I try to cut them down, someone stopped me. Don't you realize, they said, in those dead trees, that's where you have the homes of the possums and the cockatoos and the lizards and all these other beings who depend upon those dead trees for their homes. They're part of things. When I realized the value of those dead trees, they weren't ugly anymore. They were part of an Australian forest. The same with the dead parts of your life, or the ugly parts of your life. You don't see their value. They have to be there. That's the place where compassion and wisdom live, in the dead trees of your life, in the ugly moments of your day. That's why we see that these things have Buddha nature as well. We are compassionate to every moment of our life. It's easy to be compassionate to the wonderful moments, the ones you enjoy. But imagine being compassionate and seeing the Buddha nature when the eagles lose, and so do the dockers. Apparently they did that last week while I was in Thailand. Probably because I was away, that's why they both lost. I do apologize. Well, I'm here this week, so they'll probably both win. But anyhow, you can see what I mean there, that the Buddha nature is seeing something positive in every experience you have in life. So I'm a Theravada monk teaching a Mahayana doctrine. Who cares? If it works, we make use of it. And that way, with the idea of the compassion and the bodhisattva, we have this, we can make use of anything. And in the end anyway, I've used these, you know, this so-called idea of like Hinayana being selfish and Mahayana thinking of the other person. I make use of these contexts to show that both, you know, are just only one way of looking. And perhaps one of the most successful use of those concepts, you know, is in relationships, in marriages. Because I have often seen in a marriage, because you do a lot of marriage counselling as a monk, I'm the last resort. Either they come to me because they're the last resort, or they come to me as the first resort because they can't afford a real marriage counsellor. And of course you all know that I'm cheap. You know, you put a spoonful of rice in a bowl of a banana and then you can get sort of half an hour with me sometimes. Gee, it's really cheap. I'm exploited. But anyhow, cause that's what a bodhisattva is, but exploited. We don't charge anything. Anyway, one of the great teachings about marriage is, in a marriage, you know, the two people, it can be a gay marriage, it can be a straight marriage, whatever, there's always one partner who's the Hinayana, and there's one partner who's the Mahayana. The Hinayana is the selfish one. They're just in it for themselves and what they can get out of the marriage. And the Mahayana is the one who sacrifices, gives themselves up to the other person. And, unfortunately, it is true that Hinayana is usually, but not always, the man. The Mahayana, the women, they want to sacrifice themselves for the marriage. And you'll find that both are wrong. Both are what we call dysfunctional. It doesn't work. If you're the selfish one in the marriage, what I can get out of this, just thinking of yourself, that's no way to have a relationship. In the end, you're missing out on what a relationship, what a marriage, what a partnership is. You just get selfish. You just get frustrated. Because you never get what you want. But the other person is even worse. The Mahayana, who's sacrificing themselves for their partner or for their marriage. And many of you may have been there and know what it's like. After a while, you're getting nothing back in return. You get, again, frustrated, despondent. There's nothing there for you anymore. You just give, 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 give. You get nothing back. You get dried out, burnt out, nothing left. And you split. Both are dysfunctional. It's not Mahayana giving to the other person. It's not what you're getting. It's instead of Hinayana and Mahayana, it is the middle way. It's not him or her, it's not me, it is us. I said that even a couple of days ago at a marriage, telling people that this was a couple in Bangkok, quite a high class couple, and I've known the man for a long time now. You know, he was in Melbourne studying, being a doctor. I've known him since he was quite small. Now he's found a bride. So they came to see me in Bangkok a couple of days ago. You know what it's like when they're in love, about to get married, just really big-eyed and looking at each other, just really daft. And I said the same old thing. I said, you know, Nam, I know you're going to get married soon, you know, to Dao, that was the girl. So Nam, you know, from now on you must never think of yourself. And Dao, you know, the girl, you must never think of yourself now. You shouldn't get married. And they nodded, yes. You know, because when you get married, you're supposed to be selfless. And I said to Nam, Dr. Nam, I said, now from now on, you must never think of her either. And that's when he started getting confused. I love this moment, confusing people. Because when you're confusing people, you open their minds up so you can actually teach them something. If you tell them what they already know, they're always closed. Yeah, I know this. You've got to confuse people first of all. So I said, Nam, from now on you must never think of her. And he was really scratching his head. What do you mean? This is my wife. Of course I've got to think of her. I said, no, don't think of her from now on. I looked at the wife down. Never think of your husband from now on. And she was really confused. Because both are wrong. Thinking of the other person is Mahayana. Thinking of yourself is Hinayana. I say, from now on you must think of us. You're a pair. If you think of him or her, you think of me, you're missing where the action is. A relationship does not happen in the partner. It does not happen in you. It happens in the space between the two of you. It's the us where the relationship happens. And they got it pretty quickly. As many people get it once you see the problem of a relationship. You're looking in the wrong place. Either you're looking in yourself, what's in it for you, or you're sacrificing for the other person, looking at them. You're not looking at the space between the two of you, where us exists. Which is like the Hinayana-Mahayana idea in Buddhism. Those two ideas are completely ridiculous. The Buddha never taught Hinayana, never taught Mahayana. The two are completely sort of dysfunctional. It's not about me. It's not about you. Even as a monk living in Perth for such a long time, I never sacrificed myself for you. I never sort of think of me. It's always and always will be us. We're in it together, wherever I am. It's not sort of me and you and them. It's always the us. The relationship every Friday night when I open my mouth and the words flow between myself and you. This is where the action is. So real Buddhism, that's why they call it middle way. What's between us? What's even between, you know, the observer and the observed in meditation? It's not what we do, but how we do it. Our relationship to every moment of our lives. So it doesn't matter if you're having a hard time. It's how you're having a hard time. It doesn't matter if you're having a wonderful, happy time. It's how you're having that happy time. Whether you're sick or whether you're healthy, it's how you're sick, how you're healthy. Whether you're celibate, whether you're gay, whether you're married, whether you're old or young, it's how you do these things. What's between you and the world, the middle way. When you understand that, you understand all these different traditions, the Tibetan tradition, the Zen tradition, Theravada tradition, forest tradition, the city tradition, all these other traditions which we have. They're all pointing in the same place. The traditions are just externals. You may chant in different languages, you may use different similes. These days we borrow from each other. Because look, there's no sort of copyright in Buddhism. Monks aren't going to sue nuns. So I'm quite free to use any sort of teachings of anybody else. And this is wonderful to be able to have that sort of trust, because the Dharma is important. The teachings, the truth, that is our leader. That is our boss. Truth, compassion, virtue, honesty. And no one can own that. No group, no sect, no leader, no pope can actually own that and be the infallible owner and franchisee of Buddhism. That's why it is very appropriate to our modern world. Why it is like free. Why we don't charge for things, because I don't own these teachings. Never have, never will. We always give. Because we give, there is no hierarchy. And you're very free to argue with me. And anything I say here that, gee, I wished I could excommunicate a few of you over these years. No, not really. Because you can do whatever you like. You can take these teachings and make use of them whichever way you want. And there's no controller which will tell you what to do. You give these teachings and it's an empowerment for you to find your own way of using these great teachings. And really, there is as many types of Buddhism, not just the three vehicles. There are millions of vehicles. However many Buddhists there are that many different types of Buddhism. But as long as it follows that same basic principles, every now like a virtue which comes from within, not taught by a supreme being or supreme monk or a supreme nun or a supreme layperson in funny hat, it's from your own heart. It's a teaching of Buddhism which comes from within you, which explains the relationship which you have to the world, which you have towards your partner, which you have to yourself, which you have to your life. It's teaching that relationship the middle way. Seeing the Buddha nature in everything. And as far as compassion comes, that's a natural part of the whole thing. And as far as peace comes, this is what happens when you follow these teachings. If they are teachings which reflect our modern world, which address the problems which each one of you face, if they are really getting to the nub of your life, they solve those problems. And when those problems get solved, you have peace, you have meaning. you realize what truth is. Truth is not what's found in a book. And you can't say that you've got the truth and other people haven't. Or your truth is better than the truth of the next group or monastery or temple. The truth is in everybody's heart. You can no longer own the truth and you can own the air. People actually have been bottling water. I often actually noticed, years ago I noticed this, that Evian water is naive, spelt backwards. Evian. You write it down, spell it backwards, it's naive, spelt backwards. Sometimes people try and bottle water and sell it. And what we do now, I'm sure that people try and bottle air and sell it soon. You can't own the air, but certainly people bottle truth and sell it. But we will never do that. The truth is in your heart. And you don't sort of distinguish between the different traditions. And so those traditions which we had, Mahayana, Theravada, Zen, Hinayana, this tradition, that tradition, if anyone ever comes along and says their tradition is superior than others, just shake your head. Truth is truth is truth. No tradition owns the truth. There's no hierarchy of truth. And we can share our traditions. What we see is just cakes, the same taste, the same cake underneath with just different icings. We can make use of all these traditions, which is why that we do have harmony. Why that monk I was mentioning in Singapore, when he became the abbot of the biggest temple in Singapore, big Mahayana temple, he invited many great Chinese monks, Mahayana monks, but he also invited me. And I was the one who gave the keynote address as he became an abbot of the biggest temple in Singapore, biggest Chinese temple. An English Theravada monk gave the keynote speech for him. What a wonderful gesture that was. Because we're actually showing, not just in speeches, we're showing in actions. Just how, doesn't matter what tradition you are from, we are all, as it were, children of the Buddha. Same family, different clothes, different speech, but brothers and sisters in the Dhamma. And we mean that. No distinctions, no separations. Too many distinctions and separations in this world already. It's about time we take them down. We're taking them down already in Buddhism. Has taken it down between different religions, different races, so we can have mutual respect. If you like, seeing the Buddha nature in all beings, in all experiences, opportunities to learn and grow. Thank you. Okay, has anyone got any questions about Buddhism and sex? S-E-C-T-S. Someone's waving out there. Do you want to come in? Any comments or questions about the Dalai Lama or about... Yeah. Has a what? Is the Dalai Lama going to visit Serpentine? No, the Dalai Lama will not go and visit Serpentine. So Serpentine will go and visit Dalai Lama. So about a dozen of us will be going to that talk. And only about two or three monks will be looking after the shop. No, because apparently that we found out it was actually the Australian police don't want him to go very far. Because, you know, being a sort of a big celebrity, there's always a few crazy people who might like to knock him off, and so because of that, he's just staying in town. So not even to Nolamara, no, I'm sorry. And unfortunately, he can't come to your house either, just to drop him. But sometimes it's nice to have a celebrity Buddhist. That's the role he sometimes does. Be like a figurehead, and you know, he does a good job. because he does. He's like what I was talking in Bangkok about leadership, and he leads by example. Now, because just his lifestyle, the way he talks, what he does. And there's so few people actually lead by example these days. You know, you can have politicians, and there's always some scandal coming up. And I'm sure that, if there was a scandal with the Dalai Lama, if he got caught in Northbridge on Wednesday night, stone drunk in the pub, that would be big news all over the world. So it's obviously that never happens, because he would have got caught out by now. So, he's someone who does lead by example. He's actually a virtuous leader. And that's rare in our world. All the other celebs are always going detox, in Betty Ford Clinic. But I don't think the Dalai Lama would ever go there, except maybe do some chanting for his celebrity friends. But isn't it wonderful you have actually a religious leader who is pure and is worthy of respect, who's actually been scrutinized over many years? Good on him. And then actually says sensible things as well. Any other comments or questions before we finish off? Yes, I did say yes. What does it mean? It means freedom from hairdressers. When I shave my head, what does it mean for me? That was the question. I hated going to hairdressers when I was a kid. They would never get it right. And finally, you shave your head and it's right. As a monk, you never, or a nun, you never have a bad hair day ever again. Do you have to shave your head? As a Buddhist, you can see there's many Buddhists here, they don't shave their heads. It's only monks and nuns shave their heads. And that's a great thing to do. It makes you feel very free. You don't have to have a comb and a brush in the morning. You just stand under the shower, you wash your hair at the same time. Oh, it's so wonderful actually being bald. And that's actually a good question, because on Sunday, where is she? Training the children, yeah. That one of our members is shaving off her hair, a lady. She's got a permission from her husband and to shave off her hair as a fundraiser for our retreat centre project, where you can all learn meditation. She's doing that on Sunday at 3 p.m. Shaving off all her hair. She's not a monk, or she's not a nun. Ordinary lady shaving off her hair for charity. Any other volunteers for Sunday? Give it a try. It's great fun. You can get sponsorship. And you can get sponsorship from people, to shave off your hair. But then if you say you get sort of $100 or $200, you can actually tell your husband, look, $200 to shave off my hair. If you want to keep it, it'll cost you $250. I should have been in marketing. But it's just simplicity, because we don't have to worry about personal appearance. Because a lot of times there's a lot of ego involved in your personal appearance and what you look like, especially your hairstyle. Shave it off and there's no sort of, a lot of ego has disappeared. A lot of sense of self. That's one of the reasons why it just gets rid of your ego and attachment to your self-appearance. There's another question over there in the corner? No? Okay, we've gone over time now. It's almost getting 6 minutes past nine. So we'll finish off today. So thank you for coming. Hopefully see some of you on Sunday for our Waisak celebration. Which are you going to talk about now?
Arahang Sammasambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang Namassami Supatipanno Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami